You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is the 1st of September, 2024. To my donors, I thank you very much, and you know who you are. You guys keep me independent, and you guys keep me focused. Given that, what we're going to talk about today, or tonight, is an atrocity in the Soviet Union that very few people know about. And that's the Kazakh genocide of 1930 to 1933. Sometimes it's called the Goloshkin genocide, named after the Jewish dictator of Kazakhstan at the time. The Kazakh Autonomous Socialist Soviet Republic, the ASSR. And the Kazakh genocide of 1930 was a famine during which roughly 2 million people died in this autonomous republic. Of that, roughly 2 million, 1.5 million were ethnic Kazakhs. And depending on who you read, anything from 40 to 42% of all ethnic Kazakhs died, which was a very high percentage in terms of ethnocide and genocide. The highest I've seen in terms of deaths is 2.3 million. And given the years that I've already stated, collectivization is at the root of all of it. In Kazakhstan, the famine began in the winter of 1930, and that was before the Holodomor began in Ukraine. The famine was so bad and quite deliberate, and it reduced the Kazakh population to such an extent that they became a minority in their own country, not just from starvation, not just from shootings, not just from imprisonment, but also from out-migration. And it wasn't until the middle of the 1990s that targeted investment brought the Kazakhs to majority status. Stalin and his Jewish henchmen were at war with majority ethnicities throughout the empire, but this case is particularly heinous. Well, prior to the famine, about 65% of those living in the Republic were ethnic Kazakhs. This is a Turkic people, and Kazakh is related to the term Cossack, and they mean something similar, a free, independent man. And that was reduced to about 35% after the famine and the other concomitant killings. It's genocide, of course, and it's the point of Soviet policy. It was meant to destroy an ethnic nationalism that could directly challenge Soviet power. But the famine is an aspect of collectivization. The broader Soviet famine occurred in the middle of this from 32 to 33, but there were many others. And it wasn't merely the famine, which was artificially induced, but at the same time, Soviet leaders in Kazakhstan and elsewhere engaged in extremely repressive policies, shooting Kazakhs as they tried to flee over the border into China, and deliberately isolating and starving entire zones, areas of Kazakhstan, if Goloshkin and his friends thought it necessary. So what I'm going to do, I don't know if this is going to be one or two parts, but We're going to talk about the method the Soviets used to destroy the Kazakh economy in the 1930s. And if we have time to connect that to the failed color revolution of 2021-2022. As you know, I've said many times, advanced capitalism and Soviet socialism are very similar. These are both violent revolutionary ideologies that seek the destruction of anything that might be called traditional. Kazakhstan was a special case because they were pastoralists. They were, to a great extent, nomadic. But the point of this revolution, whether it be the Western liberal version or the Soviet version, the point is to enrich an oligarchy, a ruling class living far away, seeing a place like Kazakhstan as nothing more than raw material for their increasing enrichment globally. Both systems are at war with nationalism or any other factor that can serve as a locus of revolt. Liberalism is every bit as bloody as Bolshevism is, and it tends to take over in the same way. But for the most part, I'm going to be focused on the nature of Soviet rule in Kazakhstan in the late 20s to the early 30s, really to 1933 and a little bit beyond. Now, on this show, I've used the word collectivization 1,000 times. And I don't believe I've ever spent any length of time defining specifically what collectivization is. It was official Soviet policy, official Marxist policy. There was nothing strange about this from the Marxist point of view. Put simply, collectivization is the forcible gathering of peasants or farmers living vaguely within a specific area into large industrial farming units. Now, it began in the war communism era, which existed during the Russian Civil War, and it took the form initially of grain requisitioning, which we've spoken of in some detail. The peasantry was forced to hand over not the surplus, but pretty much anything that wasn't nailed down. And they had to give this over for a very low fixed price, if a price at all. So it led to wholesale confiscation of wheat and all kinds of grains, not to mention farm animals, all over the empire. Kazakhstan was hard hit because, again, this was a nomadic pastoral economy based on cattle breeding. Collectivization occurred after the new economic policy, and it replaced the grain requisitioning with a food tax, but it was not to last, because the new economic policy was enriching the enemies of Soviet power, largely because it was successful. The old Russian communes, the Mir, destroyed by the Reds, created a source of power beyond the control of the Soviet state. Despite the myth of the kulak, the income gap between the wealthy and the poor farmers, while grew slightly under the NEP or the some imposition of some version of the market, the division, especially when compared to today, was tiny. But this is what they used all over the empire to justify their control over the countryside. But the way that the kulak was formally defined, it was a peasant with enough land and resources to own a few animals and maybe seasonally hire a laborer or two, usually during harvest time. In reality, of course, these are middle peasants at best, but they also are the backbone of the food supply, something that was not lost on Stalin, Gulyushkin, and many other socialist planners. When anything went wrong, the kulaks were blamed, withholding their own produce in order to feed the party cadres in the cities. It was a war of the city, the Judaic urban base of the Marxists, against the countryside. Now, identifying a kulak was extremely difficult. 90% of the country's peasant population were smallholders, and many would use seasonal labor. Any peasant with a couple of cows and 4 or 5 acres, especially if it was more than everyone else in the area, would be considered a kulak. Kulak means fist, but it also means yokel. It also refers to aggression in general. It's a simpleton, and this is exactly how the regime at the time looked at its own peasantry or the nomadic herders of Kazakhstan. Of course, quickly, it resulted in massive food shortages. It never quite reached pre-war czarist levels in terms of production. And that was done either through the mayor or peasant proprietors. They were not about to give over the fruit of their labor, which, by the way, Marxism is dedicated to giving them. They were not going to violently exploit or allow themselves to be violently exploited for the sake of urban, hostile party activists. So even if you lived in the city, and we're talking about the party elite, it's kind of a code in the literature, the party elite in the cities, even they had access to 30% of the grain that they had prior to the war. All Marxist leaders agree with collectivization at some point. There's not a whole lot of middle ground in terms of the market. Lenin himself said, small-scale production give birth to capitalism, the bourgeoisie constantly, daily, hourly, with elemental force, and in vast proportions. He says this about small-scale production. He's not talking about the major banks or anything else. He wouldn't dare. So in no way could any of these men ever thought that production would increase with collectivization or anything that preceded it. As we all know, Stalin sought very rapid, heavy industrialization, which had to be financed by the agricultural surplus. That was mostly done by the Western corporations and banks, since old Russia didn't have any more the skills or the education to create a strong class of industrial workers. They used to. But by the time of the October Revolution, they no longer, or really, I should say, after the Civil War, they no longer did. This was the so-called mobilization of the peasants. Russia already had a communal structure, the labor unions, the artels in the cities. It just wasn't under party control. But it's not just to finance industrialization. It was a way to exterminate the backbone of the food supply. Therefore, famine was the goal. Stalin was incredibly suspicious of the peasants, and rightly so, since they were the threat to him and to his movement, proving that nothing was ever popular or even truthful about the Reds. In the early years of the USSR, much of the country was starving. As far as the peasantry was concerned, they either rebel or they starve. So it was in November of 1929 where the first decision was made, the Central Committee, to create a empire-wide program of collectivization. And that very same month, they also voted to accelerate it, which only increased the violence used against the peasantry. Now, the Soviets didn't have much knowledge of the countryside. No peasant was ever considered to be the owner of anything under that system. The taxes were used to pay Western companies to industrialize the country, and it didn't matter what the cost was to the actual Russian peasant, who the Jewish ruling class absolutely despised. So those that were identified as the kulak, they were transported all over the empire. They were sent to distant collective farms. The point, of course, was to break peasant production. And this is where the resistance movement began. Peasants would rather slaughter their animals for food rather than have them taken by party members. And all over the empire, you had a huge reduction in livestock, which, again, wasn't that hard to predict at the time. But under Stalin, collectivization rolled forward despite all of the violence against it. But between September and December of 1929, collectivization went up to 15% of the total agricultural population. January and February of 1930, 10 million households were forcibly collectivized, pushing the total to about 63%, and that just increased the food crisis. So to assist this, the Communist Party sent 25,000 socially conscious workers, that is to say, urban, often Jewish party members, to the countryside to continue to force collectivization. These are people who knew nothing about the working class, let alone the peasantry. They were called the 25,000ers. No one believed that they were going to get grain produced, except possibly at the barrel of a gun. So they used activists rather than just the state directly. But even Stalin admitted this in a speech on January 11th, 1933. He says, "In actual practice, we see that quite a number of district and regional party organizations are divorced from the life of the collective farms and from the requirements. People sit in offices where they complacently indulge in pen pushing and fail to see the development of the collective farms going on independently of bureaucratic offices." Well, this was forced. Therefore, it was only bureaucratic offices that forced this to happen. Their day-to-day functioning was a different matter, but he's admitting here that the people sent to make this happen knew nothing about farming. Collectivization was to create these huge industrial centers. But of course, it was a miserable failure in every way. The official description is that it was to modernize agriculture using modern equipment. Much of it came from the Ford Motor Company, but it was just a form of total control and a panopticon of surveillance. It was meant to thin out the peasantry. But the nature of communalized farms on the industrial model could only occur because the party owned everything, and only the state and party benefited. Now, in Kazakhstan, the dictator, the first secretary of the Communist Party in the Kazakh ASSR, Philip Golosukin, ruled as a dictator. Again, a Jew with exactly zero knowledge of agriculture, let alone the pastoral herding of the Kazakh nomads. But because none of these men had any understanding of agriculture, agricultural production was never the issue. It was to break the back of the peasantry, secure that the Western powers would feed the country in the meantime. Golosukin was a lifelong bureaucrat and party activist. He's never produced anything in his life. He was involved in the murder of Tsar Nicholas and family because he was a major figure in the founding of Soviet power in the Urals and part of Siberia. He was the commissar for military affairs in the Ural region and the Ural Soviet. So in 1922, the Civil War was largely over, although the peasant revolts were just getting started. He became a full member of the Central Committee of the party until 1934. And then the first secretary of the Kazakh Regional Committee of the party from 1925 to 1933. He was the chairman of the Samara Provincial Council. And he actually, you know, became an extremely powerful figure within the Soviet bureaucracy. But it was on February 19th, 1925, that he was appointed the first secretary of the party in the Kazakh Autonomous Socialist Soviet Republic. And from then on, genocide followed. He was a dictator in a very pure form because there was no real interference. He was completely autonomous. He was part of the exploitation of Kazakhstan's mineral wealth, which today remains a concern of the capitalist revolutionaries. Golosukin, then following Stalin's order, now ordered that the nomadic population would be forced to settle in collective farms. His was a deadly role in the Sovietization of the country. But of course, none of these men knew much about pastoralism, their meat and dairy-based diet. We're talking about the seasonal movement of herds across the steppe, as a response to a very thin layer of resources, especially grazing resources. Kazakhstan has a harsh climate, very diverse terrain. And so the reliance on meat from livestock was a form of winter survival. So the herders were reliant on livestock for sustenance. And I've already mentioned that the herds had been brutally thinned out once collectivization was begun, but even before then. Now, under the Tsars, there was an attempt to sell land in the northern part to peasants. But they never sought to revolutionize the society or force the nomads to settle. So dealing with the aftermath of the Civil War, and not to mention the grain requisitioning, Kazakhstan was already in serious trouble. Now, native Kazakhs, who were members of the party, local cadres, was very small. The transition to this revolutionary move and the first five-year plan was, of course, the very drive for collectivization of agriculture. It wasn't a community, but a huge collective of terrified and alienated strangers organized along industrial lines. Now, there were two famines in this era. The first emerged in the late 1920s, 1927 and 1928. The regime wants to say that it's the extreme cold, although they had dealt with that before. And the collectivization campaign actually began earlier than the initial decision. It began in 1928. The kulak, the so-called richer Kazakhs, the term there is bai, B-A-I in English, which is a local version of the kulak, and they called it Little October in reference to the October Revolution. The party was made up of various ethnic origins, but the leadership was Jewish. There were a handful of local Kazakhs who were placed in charge of deciding who was a bai and who wasn't, but these were westernized bureaucrats educated outside of the country. Not to mention, they worked only under the supervision of the party in Kazakhstan. But Kazakhstan almost immediately was purged of locals. The first purge was in 1928, and the second was in 1930, which was just at the beginning of the famine that we're talking about. Dozens, if not hundreds, of local native Kazakh party members were removed because many of them were part of something called the Alash movement, which was a nationalist political party. It's common that the left wants to blame Kazakhs, party members, for the slaughter of this era, but in fact, many of the best educated Kazakh cadres had been purged by this point. Now, of course, there wasn't a direct, although Goloshkin will say otherwise, clearly it affected ethnic Kazakhs disproportionately and brought them to marginal status. But native Kazakh cadres in the party was very small. So it isn't as if they were settled farmers sent to the collective. No, these were already very free, hence the name Kazakh, wandering nomads, pasturing. That's what was placed in collective farms. So it's doubly as evil. But as anyone could have known, as large as the collective farms were, there wasn't enough land or resources to graze 100,000 combined animals. It meant the doom of the entire country. The land didn't exist at the collective for grazing thousands of cattle, horses, or sheep, whatever. About 10,000 of the most productive of these men were deported, the so-called Bais, and members of the Alash party, and lightly, but importantly, the Islamic religious authorities. The grain and the livestock of the country by 1932 was largely in memory. And what they did produce was stolen by the party. More than 1 million tons of cereals were confiscated in 1930. Collectivization was always a declaration of war against the ethnicities of this new empire. but more than a third of all Kazakh livestock was confiscated between 1930 and 1931. They were then sent somehow to Moscow and Leningrad, of course, always the cities, meaning that the livelihoods of Kazakhs were consciously sacrificed to the greater glory of the USSR. The Soviets brought in special settlers, they called it, of various ethnicities, gulag prisoners, and Kazakhs were expelled from their land for about 200,000 of these settlers. And that's where the highly inadequate food supply went. This was a conscious attempt to break the Kazakh way of living. Whatever local help they may have had came from those already educated abroad or even in the USSR, men who were deeply alienated from their own people. Cameron is a great author, and I'm very reliant on her analysis here for at least some of this stuff. The way it worked is that a local party committee would compile a list of individuals who would be targeted as kulaks, or bai in this case. That was forwarded to the provincial party committee, and they would go over it. They have a revised list, and they would send about 1,000 officials, making a big deal that they were ethnic Kazakhs, operating under orders into the district to oversee the confiscation campaign. And they would work closely with the district-level confiscation committees and the propaganda and everything else. But this handful of Kazakh party members were always under the direct supervision of the Jewish dictator. Once you were assigned the term bai or kulak down there, you would be, and your whole family would be stripped of all, whatever property you had, and that would be sent to the collective farms. About 100 of these families were exiled, and they were sent, those that remained were sent all over the country, far from their place of origin, so they could be cut off from their networks of kin. Of course, the point is to break traditional society altogether, which is the only way that the seeds of revolution could ever be really planted. Of course, the bai or the kulak, they weren't wealthy by any means. They tended to be just opposition leaders or nationalists of one kind or another. You can't have a lot of wealth when you're nomadic. Wealth and land and property was impossible under those circumstances. So the whole thing was just propaganda and absurdity. The food aid that was sent down there would be brought to areas that the party ruled directly. And it would isolate what they considered enemies of Soviet power. Anyone who was considered counter-revolutionary starved to death. These newly settled workers, party members, that's where the food went. And whether it be incompetence or malice or both, even the food aid that went to Kazakhs was never anywhere close to being sufficient. Soviet authorities referred to Kazakhs as two-legged wolves. The Jewish leadership of Kazakhstan at the time, you know, they never used the word goyim directly, but that's exactly how they conceived of the common Kazakh herder, and simply invented a story about them being wealthy, despite the fact that that's not possible when you're largely nomadic. Stalin was upset that the grain procurement, etc., had declined within that first year, year and a half. So Stalin ordered a more repressive measure. So by 1932, you had not quite 200 districts in Kazakhstan. 32 out of them were isolated. They were blacklisted, which means that they were prohibited from any food aid or from trading with other villages. Of course, it was their death warrant. But let me quote Goloshkin here in his arrogance. He said, "The Kazakh, who has never once left his aul, which is their word for village, did not know the roads except for those of his nomadic itineraries. He now travels from one region to another in the interior of Kazakhstan. He integrates himself into Russian and Ukrainian kolkhozes, changes employment, and leaves to work on construction sites in the Volga and Siberia. Now, he thinks this is a good thing. He was a herd of cattle. The fact that these were cattle herders themselves just, you know, screamed goyim to these people. But thinking that he now has lost any sense of kin, any sense of belonging, and out, as he says, travels to Russian and Ukrainian collective farms. He has no roots anymore, and of course that was the point. He called the Kazakh herders retarded. The retardation, which was the target of his policy starting in 1925. Then he said, the old Aul is now breaking apart. It is moving towards settled life, towards the use of hay fields, towards land cultivation. It is moving from worse land to better, to state farms, to industry, to collective farm construction. Now he uses a passive voice. The old Aul is now breaking apart. No, it's been broken apart. The passive voice is a propaganda technique. It was Soviet policy that destroyed these institutions. The only thing that Golovkin cared about was the destruction of the kin networks and the nomadic life of the majority of Kazakhs at the time. The flight of the population, the mass killings, this dismantled whatever agricultural production existed there. You had popular political opposition, not to mention the special settlers, displaced inhabitants, refugees. These were all policies of the Soviet state. There was no supply chain anymore, housing and a whole bunch of other things. But this, of course, was part of the overall plan. The only people who benefited were party members, since its members never starved. By 1932, even those Kazakh cadres had condemned what was going on. And it was the Council of the President, the Council of the People's Commissars of Kazakhstan, who was a native Kazakh, Yuraz Isiev, who wrote letters to Stalin, and Golovkin blamed him, despite the fact that he was condemning what was going on in his own country. The Vice President of the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic, who was also Kazakh, Turar Ryskulov, in 1932. And of course, this is what Golovkin was, who he was trying to blame for this. He would never take responsibility for anything. But in 1933, as the famine was ending, Golovkin was replaced by another Jew, Levon Mirzoyan, who was from Armenia. He continued the same policies, but because the worst of the famine was over, he gets some credit for things. In other words, fewer people starved to death than before, therefore it was a recovery. He really hated the peasantry. He hated the nomads. He made fun of the teary telegrams of people writing Moscow saying the conditions of what's going on there. And of course, they would, if they wrote or said anything, they would be answered in kind. Again, Mirzoyan was completely alien from the population. His middle name, his patronymic was Isaevich. Same thing for Golovkin, by the way. Same patronymic, typical Jewish name. And they would do things like have, you know, parties, wedding festivals and things like that, while the population around them starve. Again, Mirzoyan has zero agricultural knowledge or experience, and he simply ordered the killing of anyone who fled, any refugees that were returned, and was just as violent as his predecessor. Stealing grain, fleeing. This was to be an enemy of the USSR, and really almost everyone in under starvation conditions could be put into that category. But he was a dictator, Mirzoyan, and he was violent towards refugees and denied food aid to areas that hosted refugees or that caused refugees. What was left of the Kazakh cadres were removed under him. Any party member asking for more food aid was blacklisted. That was essentially, you know, what it comes down to, these blacklisted areas. These are zones of starvation. And the only thing that saved Minnesotan was the fact that there was a there was excellent weather and a substantial harvest in 1934. But that was despite Soviet policy, and it was nowhere near what it was prior to all of this. Mirzoyan was a huge part of the Great Purge, and he claimed to be fighting counter-revolutionary groups at work in Kazakhstan. He explicitly placed the responsibility for the slaughter in his own hands. He blamed a man by the name of Uzakbay Kulumbetov. He was the nominal president of Kazakhstan, but he, of course, he had no power as a leader of the conspiracy that completely derailed collectivization. The man, of course, was shot as a result. These Jews refused to take any responsibility for their crimes, blaming local Goyim, many of whom they put in power. The two names that I mentioned that they tried to blame, these were people put in power by the Jewish oligarchy. And one of the reasons that they were placed there was to take the blame when things invariably went badly. Well, in 1938, that was the end of Mirzoyan's career. He was executed early in 1939. Once their use to Stalin was exhausted, they were then used, despite them being dictators and overseeing all of this, even them trying to blame Kazakh Goyim for the problems didn't work after a while. Now, Little October, this revolutionary collectivization campaign did break Kazakh society. It neutralized resistance nationalists, such as the Alash Party, the old nomadic aristocracy, which of course was hardly wealthy. Only then, only in the late 30s, did you have some local commoners promoted to party positions. It was the confiscation campaign itself that brought these alienated, largely foreign-educated Kazakhs into the party. Economics was never at the root of this. It was destruction of a lifestyle or an ethnic group that possibly would threaten this absurd revolution. And I mentioned the fact, I made a big deal about local party members, because this is an excuse that the regime's academics use quite a bit. Since Kazakhs slaughtered Kazakhs, in their mind, which is not true, but they think that's the case, therefore it's not genocide. We'll get to that here in a minute. The revolution certainly was not a Kazakh affair because there was violent resistance movements. There were 8 armed rebellions in 1930 alone. Between 1929 and 1931, you had 15,000 rebels forming an army in Kazakhstan. They took over the city of Suzak and Ilgiz. I don't think I'm pronouncing those right, but I don't care. They actually returned confiscated property. They destroyed the collective farms. And, of course, they took revenge on the party members in these cities. They even opened mosques and things like that. But unfortunately, as with all these rebellions, they were never joined together. And not only did they receive no support from anywhere else, the West, to the extent they even knew about it, condemned them, because this was at a time where major American corporations were going in and building the Soviet socialist paradise. From 1929 to 1931, there were at least 15 major armed conflicts in the country. So the fighting then added another reason for this country to fall apart. Thousands of Kazakhs fled to Turkmenistan and over the Chinese border. And as that continued, you had a massive escalation in state violence. Of course, the only thing that the party newspapers would say, or American academics would say, is that these rebels took revenge on party members. Most of the uprisings took place in nomadic areas. And nomadic areas were the hardest hit of all. In the southern regions, religious factors were more important. But some of the party's own members were participants in these rebellions. against the Red Army. So this was a dissolution of whatever local support they ever had. Therefore, by 1932, there was no local support for the continuation of the famine for another year or so. Of course, the results of Little October are and were predictable. Gabit Musripov, who was a Kazakh writer, talked about corpses stacked up like firewood along the roadside. The book Famine, Memory, and Politics in the Post-Soviet Space, Contrasting Echoes of Collectivization in Ukraine and Kazakhstan, lays out a lot of testimonies from survivors. But the corpses were everywhere. Some of the worst regions hit by the famine was in Kazakhstan for these very reasons. But more than half its population was lost in the famines of 1919, 1922, as well as the one we're talking about, 1930, 1933. This was directly due to the actions of the Jewish dictator, or the two Jewish dictators of the country. So the official census, though, had the number of ethnic Kazakhs in the country in 1926 were about 3.6 million. In 1937, so 11 years later, it was 2.1 million. But of course, this was the goal. The Ukrainian population that had been sent to Kazakhstan decreased from almost 900,000 in the same time period to just over 500,000, about 36% of the population. How many died? How many fled? Numbers are fairly tight. There's not a huge variance. It's between 800,000 and 1.1 million that fled the country. And they went everywhere from China to Iran, Turkey, and elsewhere within the empire. And the refugees took almost 1 million head of cattle along with them because that was their entire life. They were executed the minute any of them were brought back. The repatriation process was absolutely brutal. And their homes were filled with these new settlers. So they were, even if they returned, they were expelled from their place of birth. About 30% of the refugee population died of various forms of epidemics, disease, and hunger itself. Some of the books in my bibliography here talk about the fact that these refugees who tried to be integrated into the collective farms were too weak to do anything. And most of the refugees were thrown out after a few days. They were murdered, in other words. Abzanov, a professor and director of the Institute of History and Ethnology at the Academy of Sciences down there, said a full sixth of the indigenous population left their historical homeland forever. And this was no accident. But the refugees, the mass death, this was an embarrassment to the extent that, I mean, the Chinese knew about it. The Americans refused to talk about it. But admitting it from the Soviet point of view would be an admission of both genocide and total failure. It's interesting that the Jewish dictators of Kazakhstan are often dropped out of analysis so as not to put too much attention on them. Thousands of Kazakhs were shot dead as they attempted to flee, especially the Kazakh-Chinese border. And one of those very infamous incidents was the Karatal affair on the Chinese border, where you have eyewitnesses, including one doctor, and this is from the Cameron book of 2018, where the slaughter of Kazakhs by the border guards, accompanied by the rape of several women and children, and the doctor who testified to this examined the women, and in fact, they were raped. So clearly, this was genocide. Most of the people who were killed here were not military resistors. Simply trying to escape was enough to be murdered. The Soviets, as I've already cited, Voloshkin and others, tried to frame their flight as a progressive movement. They were moving away from their primitive lifestyle towards the glorious Soviet future. I cited Golovkin above, talking about moving from place to place. He's talking about refugees, pretending that they are successes rather than failures of his own policy. By the time the Jewish leadership in Kazakhstan was finished, in late 30s, you had a 80% reduction in the herds. It was absolutely impossible for the old economy to be rebuilt. It wasn't just the mass death. It was the repatriation and resettlement program. It rendered the country completely broken. The only time the assault on nomadism or the pastoralism was stopped was during the German invasion. Now, one of the worst insults with all of this, and this is relatively well known, is a debate over whether or not this counts as a genocide. And the same thing goes for the Ukrainian Holodomor issue. Now remember, they're using the UN definition, which was mostly created and defined by the Soviet Union. Since they helped define the term, it's unlikely that this very technical and academic debate act goes anywhere. Now, the Kazakh parliament in 1991, chaired by a guy named Manash Kozyrbayev, committee was created to investigate the famine and its causes. The commission, led by him, came out and said, "The magnitude of the tragedy was so monstrous that we can, with full moral authority, designate it as a manifestation of the politics of genocide." And of course, that had absolutely no impact on those in academia who were trying to pretend that it wasn't. Niccolo Pianzola, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, tried to deny that this was genocide because other people other than Kazakhs were murdered here. But that's ridiculous. Even the Jewish Holocaust, it wasn't just Jews. But it also, these debates assume that Soviet press releases should be taken at face value. But because there were a few Mongolian or North Asian peoples that had the similar treatment by the USSR, therefore this can't be considered genocide. Now, Vladimir Burtsev, who's actually a friend of Goloshkin, here's how he was described, and this goes to this debate. This was a first-hand account. Talking about Goloshkin, he is a typical Leninist. This is a man that does not stop at any bloodshed. This trait is especially noticeable in his nature. The executioner, cruel, with some elements of degeneracy. In party life, he was arrogant, a demagogue, a cynic. He didn't believe Kazakhs were people at all. Goloshkin did not have time to appear in Kazakhstan, as he stated that there is no Soviet power, therefore it's necessary to orchestrate a little October. Well, that is purely Talmudic. Elements of degeneracy, I think they mean sexual degeneracy. I don't know what else that could be. But arrogant, a demagogue, a cynic, and dehumanizing the Kazakh population as retarded primitives. This is the Jewish mind at work. And none of this should surprise anybody. And the literature on whether or not this was genocide tries to avoid putting too much attention on these men. An idiot named Stephen Wheatcroft, he is a historian in specializing in the USSR, typical academic, says that this is an act of negligence, criminal negligence, but negligence. It wasn't intentional murder, and certainly not genocide. You know, he takes Soviet propaganda as actually reflecting elite attitudes and ideas. The Soviets were well aware that collectivization would destroy the economy, and that was the point, to break it. This nonsense of Wheatcroft implies that these ideological or political goals were unimportant. Stalin has given a free moral pass. Sarah Cameron, who I've mentioned already, she wrote The Hungry Steppe, Famine, Violence, and the Making of Soviet Kazakhstan, takes a different point of view, of course. It does fit the definition of genocide, because the point was to disrupt Kazakh society. And she seems to suggest that it's easy to dismiss violence committed against nomads, that this was a natural process. Because again, capitalism and Marxism are very similar. She even says that the literature on this famine is called a miscalculation, a mistake by Stalin. And we all know why they're doing this. And she also goes on to say that pastoral nomadism is not a backwards way of life. It's highly sophisticated and adaptive. The Soviets didn't know that, and the capitalists don't know that. Debating over the UN definition is utter nonsense. The USSR was quite aware of what collectivization would do. It was going on in European Russia at the same time. Agricultural production was not the main purpose, and the results were predictable, especially under the Jewish leadership at the time. There's a number of other scholars, Anton Weiss-Wendt, Anna Applebaum, interesting names. And they're the ones who make the argument that the Soviet definition imposed on the UN of what genocide is was specifically stated in such a way that it couldn't include Soviet crimes. He said, well, the Holodomor doesn't meet the criterion laid out by the UN, but given that the Soviets helped shape the language precisely in order to prevent Soviet crime from being so considered, from being classified as genocide, of course it's not going to be. But you have people who continue to want to give Stalin a free pass. No one calls them genocide deniers or anything like that. Robert Kindler is the one who claims that Kazakhs were killing Kazakhs, therefore it couldn't be genocide. That nations, the nations themselves, the victims, are responsible for their victimization. Well, as we have already discussed, only a handful of party members were Kazakhs at the time. Bringing a handful of Kazakhs into the party was meant to destroy old allegiances and sow conflict. But let's get into this issue. How accurate is the idea that this genocide was even in part carried out by Kazakh members of the Kazakh ethnicity? In 1926, the Kazakh Communist Party had 31,910 members. 11,000, about 36.5%, were Kazakhs. And this is before the purges, as I mentioned already. But about 16% of any of the high-ranking positions were occupied with people who could speak the language, the Kazakh language. So you had people making decisions on the republic who didn't know the language, who didn't understand the economy. These were alienated, in many cases, alienated urban Jews who despised these people as absolute goyim. In fact, you know, they were cattle herders. A tiny minority of party work came from Kazakhs. And the debate over whether or not this is genocide is so insulting, but it is artificial. It relies on technical terms, and why it has to fit the UN definition is never quite explained. But we know the motivations of these people in this debate. I've only mentioned a smattering of them. The point of all of this is to preserve the alleged Jewish Holocaust during the Second World War as a unique event. They won't admit this. This is part of the reason that it's really only Jews in this that want to talk about it as genocide. But the literature is so overly technical, whether or not acts of the USSR fit the UN definition of genocide. But beyond the Jewish angle, to include the USSR in these genocidal policies, which is far worse than Germany was ever even accused of, especially when it's under clearly Jewish leadership, to implicate them in this genocide would be to destroy the entire Allied propaganda narrative concerning the war. The Allies committed genocide. Certainly Stalin did. The Germans did not. But of course, no one can admit that. That would mean that the entire historical establishment in the Western world is incompetent, which is absolutely true. This was early on the experiments in moving ethnic populations from place to place, as I've already mentioned. The Koreans from the Russian Far East were sent to Kazakhstan in 1937. Almost 200,000 were relocated to both Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and their Soviet guys. And part of the reason was to create an ethnic chaos. There was a Kazakh Korean scholar, Harman Kim, who argues that one of the reasons for this deportation system was based on Stalin's intent and the party's intent. I don't want to personalize it. It's the party, and they never abandoned this. Was the intent to oppress any concentrated ethnic group. Because being concentrated in a specific area would be a threat. And this was at a time of not just the starvation of an entire country, but a civil war within it against the Soviet oppressor. Very few actual Kazakh people were involved. And when the shooting started in 1931, 1932, there were no more Kazakh members of it, because the few party members were part of the revolution. Huge numbers of Kazakhs were in revolt against the Soviet system. But that doesn't seem to have any impact on the scholarly debates. So you had 1.5 million killed, maybe 2 million killed, another million fleeing the area. You had a labor shortage, obviously. And so Stalin tried to solve that problem by deporting other ethnicities there. So the Soviets would solve a problem they themselves created and then projected their guilt onto the Germans. I mentioned the dumping of political prisoners, the Gulag, the Karaganda Gulag from 1931 to 1959. It had an unknown number of deaths, but it was unknown because the Western establishment, wedded to their official narrative of the Second World War, will suppress this understanding. Again, this was projected onto the now defenseless German enemy, which really is what Nuremberg was. We've mentioned this before, too. And things didn't get any better. 1950s and 1960s, you had more forced settlement, the so-called Virgin Lands Program, which was centered in the Kazakh Soviet Socialist Republic. The influx, the deliberate, you know, influx of immigrants, this wasn't voluntary. Many were Russian and Ukrainian, skewed this ethnic mixture. And this is what, again, made Kazakhs a small minority in their own population. That had already been done, but this just made it far worse. The language, the Kazakh language, almost fell out of use entirely. And only since independence, 1991, 1992, when Kazakhstan was actually the very last country to leave the USSR, the new governments in Kazakhstan since then have tried to use and resurrect the Kazakh language. But you had Ukrainians, Germans, Belarusians, Koreans, some Chinese. In fact, the Germans of Kazakhstan were the 8% of the population. Of course, today, their descendants have no homeland to go back to. So this, it concludes the Soviet part of it, both in terms of what collectivization is and then how that was specifically imposed on Kazakhstan. Let me remind you of what Vladimir Burtsev, who knew Golovkin. Again, bloodshed, arrogance, cruelty with elements of degeneracy. Arrogant, a demagogue, and the Kazakh herders were not people. This is the Talmud in motion. This is every stereotype of the Jew is manifest in this man. So needless to say, neither one of the Jewish dictators of Kazakhstan are given any responsibility whatsoever. This is the worst kind of special pleading. In the book I've already cited, The Hungry Steppe, I want to quote some of the action against the refugees here. She writes, summarizing the reports of OGPU officials that detail the pursuit of those who fled and the accompanying violence, the Kazakh Communist Party report continues. According to the materials we have in the Karatau district, the OGPU notes that first of all, there was no resistance on the part of those fleeing. Second, that among those killed, there were many members of the poor. And third, among the living, several women and children were raped. Fourth, there was looting of those killed and those who remained alive. so it is necessary that we examine this affair more closely. Subsequent inquiries by the additional local Ogpu officials serve to corroborate that those killed, and in this case the Karatal affair, but it could be used anywhere, included the poor, those of modest means, and a doctor, after examining the women and children, confirmed that many had been raped. Now, this was just one incident, but this description, fully admitted by the Ogpu and local cadres, can be applied to the entire process. They went so far in the Soviet attempt to stem the flood of refugees, which, of course, is going to bring information elsewhere. You had those with food relief, aid. They placed the food in the back of a truck to attract refugees. Once they entered the truck, they would be locked inside, and they'd be dumped in the mountains somewhere, having no idea. We don't know today whatever happened to them. Starting in 1930, thousands of Kazakhs were shot dead attempting to flee to China. And the Soviet and the American British press all said the same thing. They took the Soviet press at its word. They were making huge profits in the USSR. They created Soviet industry, so they're not about to say anything bad. And that same procedure is occurring right now. Of course, it was genocide, just like the Holodomor is, because it was aimed, among other things, at ethnic groups that could, as a ethnic unit, as a cultural unit, as a linguistic unit, that could be the source of rebellion. If anybody knows about ethnic cohesion, it's the Jews, since that's their entire world. So when you have a huge drop, not just a huge drop in the native population such that they become a minority in their own country, you have no choice but to consider it genocide. For these idiots, people like Wheatcroft and others, to say this was simply a miscalculation or criminal negligence. This guy is teaching in a university? Has he never read Stalin before? Has he never read? Of course, he doesn't want to talk about Gloshkin, who says openly that this is a war on Kazakh herders, Kazakh society. We know why they have to make this argument. We all know why they have no choice but to support the Allied narrative of World War II, which means the Soviet Union could not be responsible for this. And it shows you, this is a dishonesty. This is the special pleading. This is why these debates are so technical and only use the UN definition, because they're well aware that that definition was written by the Soviets in the fraud of Nuremberg, which was one huge form of neurotic projection of Soviet crimes onto the Germans that at this point couldn't defend themselves. Anyway, that's it for me this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.